Okay then, Michelle.
Okay.
Well, Michelle, we're here for West Coast Project and Fargo Season 2, Episode 1.
Yep.
How did you like this episode, Michelle, from Tennessee?
You know, I loved this episode. I loved it. I thought it was... I don't know if I was just in the mood, you know, or what, but I loved it. I was so shocked by my reaction to it until the last, like, 3 minutes. And I just almost wanted to throw my hands up in the air, honestly.
All right, well, let's deconstruct it, see what we got.
Let's do it.
I thought it had extremely cool cars. Old period cars are very, very cool.
Yeah.
And they had one really cool overhead shot, kind of unlike True Detective, where every other shot was an overhead highway shot.
Right.
They had one super high shot, looked like 10,000 feet up of the highway. Did you notice that one?
I did notice it. It was, I wasn't even sure if it was a real shot or not. I didn't know if it was maybe something computer generated, honestly.
Well, it might have been, but it looked cool.
Yeah, it did. I agree.
So it's Noah Hawley. Noah Hawley's the writer and executive producer.
Yep.
And it's like a throwdown almost between Noah Hawley and Nick Pizzolatto here. Like, who's going to be the better season two proprietor, right, of their franchises?
I hadn't thought about that.
Round one goes to Noah Hawley.
Wasn't it great? Did you love it?
Yeah, it was good.
Okay.
So it's called Waiting for Dutch.
Yep.
And we see the very first scene. It kind of opens to an old movie, black and white movie label of a movie's first scene, and it's the massacre at Sioux Falls.
Yep.
And they're waiting for Dutch. Dutch is Ronald Reagan. They're waiting for him to get his costume together with his arrows or something.
And that's what that was, that we speculated and speculated. You know, I asked my husband about the title right after you and I did the preview, and he got it right. I mean, he didn't know, of course, that, but he did know that Ronald Reagan was called Dutch.
So you think they just used that old movie to foreshadow the massacre that happened at the diner?
Yeah, I guess. I guess they were talking about that the actual massacre had happened in that spot, and I tried to look up something about the massacre at Sioux Falls, and I didn't see anything glaring that even jumped out at me. Was it even a real movie?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, because I couldn't find it. I mean, I didn't spend a lot of time with it, but I couldn't find it. So
it looks like Indians got massacred by, or military dudes got massacred by Indians. The last guy standing's an Indian. So I don't know.
I don't
Pretty
either.
Pretty cool. They look like almost Union soldiers in their uniforms.
And
non-Indian guys. But then we see some modern flashback, or not flashback, but modern instances of the modern time. President Carter and Reagan and John Wayne Gacy.
Did you love all that? All that history?
Was it Pablo Escobar? Or was it Noriega or some cartel type looking guy?
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't know.
Well, you're doing a podcast, Michelle. Get your homework together. They also did the cool split-screen effects where you could see a couple different things going on.
You know, I really like that. I thought that was good. They did that in season one a couple times, right?
Well, you're a child of the 70s, Michelle. That's kind of 70s-ish TV and movies.
I really liked it.
Jackie Brown and...
Yep.
Starsky and Hutch and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
All right, Michelle, so we get to learn a little bit about the plot here. The Gerhardt brothers, there are three Gerhardt brothers, are the Minnesota gangsters. And their dad, I guess that guy's their dad, Otto.
Yep.
He looks just like the father in the movie Fargo. The father of the girl who got kidnapped.
Oh,
it's a dead ringer for him. I thought it was him. I was going to look it up, and then I looked a little bit more closely, and it's probably not him, but he looks just like that guy.
Oh, that would have been cool. Yeah, I didn't put it together, but you're right. I think you're right.
And they're discussing a KC gang, Kansas City gang, that's moving in on them. And then he has some sort of a heart attack or other pretty serious medical event.
Yeah, it was a stroke, I think they said.
Knocks him off his feet.
Yep.
And then we see some sort of a a deal or a sales transaction of some sort regarding typewriters. And it reminded me of the car dealership that the Lundegaard guy was in.
Yeah.
Macy was in the Fargo movie. Kind of a wacky, salesy, you're going to buy something you don't really want from me kind of sales, pushy salesman type deal.
Well, but he wasn't even really open yet, right? He just had exclusive rights to sell this state-of-the-art typewriter that corrected itself and did all that kind of stuff. But he needed funds to get this, either to get, product or to get the exclusive rights to do it or whatever. And his funds were tied up. And then he wanted Rye, the younger of the Gerhardt brothers, to forgive him of some gambling debt to help facilitate that and make him some kind of partner, I guess, in this.
Yeah, who's the guy that the typewriter guy is talking to that Rye makes leave?
I think he was just somebody who had helped him work on the store to get it open, is how I took it. He was like some kind of contractor or laborer. And the guy was wanting his money for what he had done. And maybe it was that, or come to think of it, maybe he was somebody that he was into for some gambling or something. I don't know, but he wasn't selling him anything. I didn't take it. I thought the guy was just in there trying to get money from him.
Yeah, they were just talking about the opportunity to create the business of the typewriter business.
Right.
So Riot comes in and he tells the guy to get lost. He pulls a gun, like overdoes it, right? He doesn't need to be that extreme. He pulls a gun on the guy, tells him to get lost.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the deal. They need money for marketing and sales of this typewriter deal, but a judge has frozen the money that they need to get access to.
I don't even know how that works. I was trying to figure out how that would work, how the judge would freeze somebody's money.
Well, maybe he's a shady businessman in some other regard, and he's got some other deal.
Oh, okay.
And the judge just made some decision that you can't do this illegal stuff, so I'm going to freeze your bank account until we get it figured out.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't know. They don't really tell much about it.
Right.
But Rye follows this judge now to the Waffle Hut, and we're going to see what happens regarding this massacre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the time I wrote this note, I know now, but I put it's either quickly becoming morning or evening. The light's really changing, and apparently it's gotten darker, so I think it's becoming evening.
Yeah.
But I thought morning maybe because they're going to the Waffle Hut. But apparently the Waffle Hut's a 24-hour get anything you want any time of day.
Well, right. And the judge had just come out of the courthouse, too. And you would think that would not be in the morning when she'd be coming out of the courthouse, that he was following her. And plus, he had just met with his brothers. Remember, his brothers were upset with him, or his brother, that he hadn't come through with the family money. So that was at noon that day. So I thought that was like, progression of the day. I agree. I think it was in the evening.
All right. So the light's changing. And then Children of the Sun, this old 70s song, comes on. Australian rocker Billy Thorpe. Do you remember that song?
Oh, do I ever? And I mean, it really took me back to hear that.
We see some more split screens. We see the Otto patriarch dude is really sick. The other brothers, what are the brothers' names? They have funny names.
Bear and Dodd.
Bear, Dodd, and Rye.
Rye.
Yeah, they're waiting on some other, plots or contrivances. They're just kind of sitting around thinking and waiting.
And probably a little worried about their father at that point.
Man, not too worried.
No, okay.
So the Waffle Hut, we find out, is in Lucerne, Minnesota, and it's open 24 hours. And Michelle from Tennessee, it has a dopily friendly waitress who wants to know of Rye, do you want a table or a booth? And the night specials are a tuna melt. So that's more clues. It's evening. It's like dinner-y food.
Sure.
And I thought Rye was a dead ringer for Steve Buscemi from the movie. And his look... Oh.
Yeah.
In his mannerisms. He has one point where he holds the back of his hand to his forehead, like Buscemi does when he gets shot through the jaw.
That's a really good point.
He looks exactly like Steve Buscemi. And he's kind of goofy like him, too. He's kind of frenetic and jumpy and nervous.
Yeah, and over the top in a lot of the things that he's doing. I agree.
So there's a lot of common resemblances to the movie, but they don't look like they're copying things, and they don't look like they're just, like, retracing steps. It just looks really cool.
I agree. Not in any way. It didn't in any way feel like they were trying to recreate anything. You just felt like it was the same place, you know, just with the nuances and stuff of the same place and characters that you had before, which I thought was brilliant.
So kind of a callback to season one, this Waffle Hut looks a lot like Lou's restaurant in season one. Maybe all restaurants in Minnesota look like this, but kind of long and thin, like almost like a train car.
Yeah, just like a little diner place. Yeah, I could see them.
So at the restaurant, Rye confronts the judge, and she's this severe, stern-looking woman, real tied-down-looking, straight-laced woman. She just says, look, buddy, I'm not buying what you're selling, no matter what you're going to tell me. And Rye says, well, you're going to change your mind about a case. And she immediately goes into a biblical little lesson for him.
Yeah, the story of Job.
So, do you have that story?
Well,
you know that story by heart, right, Michelle?
Well, I do. I do know the story. I mean, you know, I don't want to screw it up or anything, but basically the story was that the way she told it specifically was that the devil had made had told God that Job would turn from him. Job was like an honest, good Christian man, and the devil said that he could get Job to turn from God and curse him or turn from him or something. And God said, you can't. And so God put down all of this hard stuff on Job, and Job never would turn from God.
Yeah, the devil and God make a bet that the devil says, I can make Job. I can make Job curse your name. And I thought
Did
it was
I say
the,
Job?
Job. I think it's Job. J-O-B.
It is Job. Yeah.
But I thought it was Job who ruined... So Job ruins his fields and his flocks and all that. And Job still remains unchanged. He doesn't curse God's name.
No, he remains faithful to God through everything.
Yeah, so the devil does this. The devil makes a bet with God, makes all this terrible thing happen to Job. Job still remains faithful to God.
Right.
And so she says, if the devil couldn't change Job's mind, how are you going to change my mind, Mr. Rye, look-alike Steve Buscemi? You're pretty dim, aren't you? I think people call Buscemi dim in the movie, too. Or he calls people dim. It's really kind of a clever callback to the movie without being a copy.
Right.
And then she threateningly puts out her bug spray mace can.
That was hilarious.
Yeah, they work in some really good humor in this.
Yeah, and it was really nice. Let me say, it was really nice to have this really tense situation where we had this very, very dark, but we had this humor mixed in with it. I appreciated that for a change on some of the things that we've talked about recently. It was nice to have the comedic relief, even if it was dark and just for a second.
Yeah, so he doesn't leave fast enough. More quickly enough, and she sprays him with the bug spray. He turns around with a gun, and she just says, oh, crap. She knows in the moment of her death, about to be death, that she's going to get shot or hurt.
Yep.
And then we see the comical frying pan guy in slow motion. The cook comes around.
Yep.
With kind of a Herculean scream in the background. And then the waitress comes, pops up at the wrong time.
Yeah, she's just standing there. He went crazy with that gun.
And then the judge pops back up with a steak knife and gives him one in the back. Death everywhere. Now, Michelle, was this the massacre you envisioned when Lou Salverson first told us about it back in season one?
No, and I don't know that that's going to be the massacre that he talked about in season one, because he doesn't seem terribly affected by what's gone on. And in season one, he also brought up that bodies were stacked as high as cordwood or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And they're also not in Sioux Falls. They're in this other town, right?
Right, right.
Lucerne. So this isn't the... Because the massacre he referred to seemed very much more criminal. And,
right.
And frankly, more vicious than this goofy... This was like a slappy bitch fight even though people got killed, it was like a comedic massacre.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't think the massacre was very comedic necessarily, but I just didn't think that it was certainly to the level.
It was extremely comedic. She was a guy with a frying pan attacking a guy with a gun, and the judge pops back up and is like, oh, damn, she's going to... It was a total comedic series of murders.
Well, yeah, okay. Yeah, I get that.
And then Rye loots the cash register. And sees the staggering waitress and shoots her out in the snow. Also very reminiscent of Fargo the movie. People getting shot as they
run away
in snow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then this is where he does the back of a hand to the forehead. Like, oh my God, what? This is worse. This was a no rough stuff type deal. And here we are. I'm already over my head. Steve Buscemi, man, left and right. So, Michelle, what is the meaning of the bell? The bell is all throughout this whole episode. The bell gets the waitress caught. The bell appears in the garage scene with Rye. The bell appears when I think they put Rye in the freezer.
Oh, I don't know.
It's the Melville bell. Remember the bell, the jingle bells?
Oh my gosh, is that what that was?
It's all over. Well, there's a bell ringing just like it did with Melvo.
I'm going to have to go back and watch it now because I didn't even catch that.
So that's a mystery. And what about the spaceship that he sees?
Okay, yeah. Can we talk about that for just a minute? Was this just like a, you know, in the 70s, that's what people, you know, you heard a lot about people seeing spaceships and stuff back then, UFOs and stuff like that. Was it something like that? Was it just like a timepiece? Or was this something to show us that he was crazy? Was this something just to draw him into the road? Because it is what drew him into the road, in the middle of the road. I don't know. That was really odd to me. And it can't even come back. We can't even see that again because, you know, he's not there anymore. So it's not even like we're going to
come back. Doesn't mean only he can see it.
Well, the fact that he saw it is what I mean, is not even going to be a part of this show. So it just seems.
How do you know that?
Well, because he can't tell anybody.
Well, somebody, what if it comes back and other people see it?
Well, that's fine, but his story, I mean, yeah, it could be in the whole thing, but his story isn't going to be there. The fact that he saw it, and I just thought it was so funny to have it there, and then it just not go anywhere. I couldn't figure out why that would be there.
Well, technically, he's not dead. He's in cryogenic suspension in the freezer at Ed's butcher shop
or garage. I don't know about that.
Anyway, there's a spaceship, or it's the lights from the Corvair that drives up Kirsten Dunst's car that drives up, or it's just him dreaming, or it's a drone, or I don't know what. But it looks like the UFO that everybody hears about on, you know, the National Enquirer, where it zoomed right over me, then it flew away, then it was gone. You know, you always hear the redneck stupid people that see these things.
You've been reading the Enquirer, Mike. Yeah.
By the way, that car that she's driving is a Corvair. It's a very cool old car, mid-engine car from about that time, mid-60s. Ralph Nader took it off the road because it was not a safe car.
Yep.
I think.
Was it that? I'm not sure.
Well, he did a lot to cars, but I think he didn't like that car because it had a mid-engine and would catch on fire.
Well, that's never good.
But Kirsten Dunst is driving it, and we hear more bells when she pulls up. And now there's a lot of mystery about Kirsten Dunst. What's her name in the show?
Let me double check. Betsy? No, Betsy is Lou's wife. Peggy. Peggy's Kirsten Dunst.
All right, so she just drives off. She hits him and drives off.
With him hanging out the window. With him hanging out the window. He's stuck in the window. I mean, it's
more
not even
hanging in the window. Than
yeah. Well, yeah. Half in. I mean, it's anyway.
So we see Lou for the first time with Molly. I think it's the first time. He's reading her stories and something about the measles, which were probably a big deal back then, huh? In the 60s and 70s. Get the measles. You're supposed to only have the measles as a kid, right?
Well, you get inoculated against them. We got inoculated against the measles, so I don't know.
What was the, was it chicken pox? What was the disease that you, if you, one kid had it, they would have a party, so all the kids would come together and they would get it. So you, it's better to have it as a kid than an adult.
Yeah, well, you, just about anything, but yeah, chicken pox, I know they did that. I don't know about measles. Measles was a little more serious, but, and certainly not in the 70s, but. And but then, I realized he was reading a book from prior.
This, and then this is Betsy. His wife is Betsy. Mm-hmm. Molly's mom. Doing chores around the old Salverson household. Looks like she's doing some laundry or something.
Yep.
And Lou gets a call from work. It's the massacre show at the Waffle Hut. Now, they're calling this the massacre, but it's, I still don't think it's the massacre.
No. No, there's no way.
It's too damn funny. It's... You got massacres and you got funny massacres. This is not the serious massacre.
Lou was not traumatized by this. Lou was traumatized by the one he talks about.
Lou seems to be more traumatized about his dad coming over for dinner on the weekend.
Well, his father-in-law, right?
Oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Lou checks with Betsy to see if it's okay for him to leave because she's had her thing today, her chemotherapy.
Yeah, but we don't even know it's that at that point. And
now,
yeah.
Is this Molly's real mom or her stepmom?
No, this is Molly's real mom.
How do you know that?
Why wouldn't it be? The guy in the bingo parlor talks about, you know, this happening to her and her with the young daughter and all that. I mean, there's no reason to think it's not her mom.
All right, I'm just testing you, making sure you're paying attention. All right, Lou attends the crime scene at the... at the diner, and again, more cars are just really beautiful. The old police car they have is like totally shiny, looks brand new in 1972 or whatever year this is. The Waffle Hut looks cool, but the Waffle Hut probably looks the same today if you drove up to it in 2015.
Oh, yeah.
If it's still there. And we find out a trucker has stumbled on this crime and has called it in.
Yep.
Now, this crime is really senseless, Michelle. That's one of the reasons I think I was expecting more. It's just silly. It's really a lot of silliness. Even though Ted Danson shows up, Ted Danson's the father-in-law of Lou.
Yeah, he's Betsy's father, Hank.
And he says, well, this is really a deal. Kind of very, there's a lot of callbacks to Coen movies here, but this is very, No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
So matter-of-fact and goofy and... they see the frying pan guy, the cook who tried to help the judge, is Henry Blanton. He had a record of 31 touchdowns, Michelle, in one high school season.
Did they say that was in 31? Because that would have made that guy like in his 60s.
No, he scored 31 touchdowns.
Okay, 31. Okay. Because that didn't make any sense. I watched that a couple times.
And no, he's a kid. He's like a
that's what I thought.
Cook at a diner.
Okay.
And that record still, you know, he might be 25. Might be 8 years later, but the record still stands.
Right.
Yeah, but he's not 61. Now, interestingly, very interestingly, they don't know this judge or recognize her car, her Mercedes. So she has driven from another town and just had dinner at this diner. They don't know who she is.
Yeah, I mean, was she, like, stopping along her way home? Did she live that far away? I didn't understand that either, because I did think that was odd that they knew the cook, but they didn't know the judge in the small town.
Well, the cook they see all the time, that's their town.
Well, sure, but that's what I meant. You know, we did find out that she was quite a ways from home, right? Or from where she works.
I have no idea.
Or from home. Well, she'd have to be, because they'd know her, right?
Well, do you know everybody in Chattanooga?
No, but Chattanooga's a little bit bigger, I think, maybe, than this little town was.
Lucerne, I don't know. Have you ever been to Lucerne?
That's
I mean,
a good
if it's 1,000 people, you might not know everybody. You'd think you might know a judge if you're a cop, though, if you're a couple cops, but I don't know.
Okay.
It was weird they didn't know her. That surprised me.
Yeah.
So they talk about food. This is, what's Ted Danson's name?
Hank.
Hank and Lou, father-in-law and son-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
But both sheriffs talk about food. And Lou has this new deal where they're getting recipe cards for some meals, Michelle, that you even light up on fire with a match.
You know, I remember when they sold those recipe cards on TV. And you like, it was like a monthly subscription. I swear I remember this, and I was a kid. And you, it was like they sent you a, like a little packet of recipe cards every month. And they, whatever, took 10 bucks, whatever it was, out of your checking account. And I remember that. And you know, I mean, I like to cook. I love cooking. And I loved that even as a kid, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to get those recipe cards. Of course, now we have the internet, you know, and everything else. You don't need the recipe cards. But I remember that, and it was like the coolest food I'd ever seen in my life. That
did you light Meals on Fire as a kid when you were starting out your culinary career?
You know what? I didn't, but I didn't realize that it was that we would light them on fire after we made a perfectly good casserole.
Was your dad a fireman? Like, he banned it from the house?
No.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, they do, they noticed the skid marks of the car, Kirsten's car. What's her name?
Kirsten Dunst is Peggy.
Peggy's car. And there's one car too many in the lot, in the parking lot, compared to the number of bodies hanging around. So that's a mystery. So they're kind of clever, dopey. Like, they're dopes, but they're clever. They notice the details that will ultimately probably lead them to the solution.
Yeah, I don't think they're dopey. I think they're dopey kind of like Molly was dopey last season, but she was taking it all in. I guess we'll see. But I don't trust their dopiness. I don't trust them to be as dopey as they sound like they are.
So they notice a couple other clues. The shooter has a wound. There's blood drops out in the road. And they wonder, well, why didn't he take his own car? Why would he need to get a ride?
Well, sure. I mean, you wouldn't want to leave your car.
And then they see a shoe up in the tree. It's probably one of Rye's shoes.
It is. It is one of his shoes. He's, you see him on the hood of the car, and one of his shoes is off. If you go back and look.
One of his patent leather white shoes.
White shoes, yep.
All right, so they firm up their dinner plans for the weekend and separate with father and son-in-law cops.
That's a heck of a hit, right? I mean, she really hit him hard for his shoe to fly off and go up in a tree.
I don't know, you flip around, you know?
I guess.
You leverage your, you kick your foot up? I don't think so.
Ah, I thought that was pretty horrifying.
So we get to go to the butcher shop now, and we're going to meet Jesse from Breaking Bad.
Yep.
A fat Jesse.
That's not nice.
Well, he's very fat.
He's not very fat. He's just a little plump. He just hasn't went Hollywood.
He's fat. he gets some sweet chops that nobody picked up, but they paid for.
Yep.
And then we hear, okay then, times three.
Yeah, that was cute. I like that.
I thought it was cute at the beginning of the podcast, but you didn't pick up on it.
Oh, I thought it was pretty good.
So we meet Carl now, Nick Offerman, at a bingo game. Now, is this like a veterans hall of some sort? It's got to be, right? It's got bomber wallpaper and...
Yeah, I would assume. I would assume it's some kind of VFW or something.
Bingo. He's talking about conspiracies between Ho Chi Minh and Ike and the whole military-industrial complex conspiracy. And
special interests and, yeah.
Lou shows up and offers to these guys that the Waffle Hut was a botched robbery. And that's his first. So this is he's kind of figuring it out, but he's not really tuned in perfectly yet to what it really was. Right, I guess it'd be hard to know what it really was.
No, I mean, how would you know? Because Rye did take the money. So
Carl offers up some more theories on the Kennedy assassination and Watergate.
This was just absolutely, I mean, there was so much history sprinkled into this one episode.
And then he compares this cancer bullshit with John McCain holding out as a prisoner of war. If he can hold out, then your wife can hold out against this cancer BS.
If he can hold out 5 years of thumb screws, I think is what he said, something to that effect, then your wife, then, you know, Betsy's got this. She can do
pretty
this.
Close to being insulting to Lou, pretty much here. Right? It's cancer. You don't quite hold out against cancer like you do against
of course
an
not.
Enemy torturing you.
No, but I don't. I mean, he was kind of opinionated anyway, and I think he was just trying to show his support.
He's well intentioned, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I thought so. It was. That's just that whole cancer thing. How they kind of just bring it in like that is. That's scarier to me than the massacre in this episode was. So,
why?
Because it's horrifying, you know? I mean, you got this young mom, and she's got this little girl, and she's going about her business, and you don't even know that she's going through this, and they just kind of, like, let... It just, like, kind of drips into the episode. You know, you kind of forget about it, because Lou will say something about, how was your day? You had that thing, and then... You know, and a little drip of something falls in, and you're like, ooh, what was that? And then you forget about it, and then somebody else brings it up, and then you forget about it, and then somebody else brings it up, and it just kind of permeates the whole atmosphere of the Salverson household.
Hey, what happened in season one with Colin Hanks' wife? She was kind of deceased, too, wasn't she?
She was.
Was that cancer, too?
I don't remember. I don't remember. It's a good question.
All right, Michelle. Well, now we see a trope that I really dislike a lot in TV and movies and in real life, and the way it happens in TV and movies is the dude takes one sip of his beer and then wants to leave, and in real life girls take one sip of their beer and set it down at a party and never pick it up again.
Is that how it works?
Yeah, you always find a beer with, like, you know, totally full, top popped off with one sip gone, and it's a girl's, you know, oh, I don't like this, or I'm full.
Go ahead and drink it then?
No, they just don't finish it. Oh, but okay. He's at a veterans hall, and he has one sip of a beer, and he wants to leave. And finish your damn beer, dude. Why even go if you're going to have one sip?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that he was even going to... I didn't really understand that whole scene, if you want to know the truth of it, because he had been at home, and then he'd gotten called away to the scene, and then he stopped by there on his way back home. And that just seemed like an odd time to stop because he had already worked all day long, and then he went home, and then he, you know, got called back, and in place of just going back home because he's tired and he's got to work tomorrow, he didn't, and he, you know.
Well, especially if he's feeling the urgency of his wife having just gone through chemo that day and he wants to get back to her.
Right,
didn't make much sense.
No, but I didn't think
what
so.
Made less sense is to sip one sip out of a beer and not finish it.
Okay.
All right, so then Fat Ed goes home to Kirsten Dunst. And they're having, what are they having, tater tots and?
Hamburger Helper.
Okay.
The food of the 70s, right?
And then they had a weird prayer before their meal where he kind of stood, like, awkwardly across the table and held her hand.
Oh, he wasn't standing. He was sitting in that chair she designated him to because she had all of her crap in his chair. And so he's in, like, this high chair thing. This awkward, uncomfortable, metal-looking chair in place of, she wouldn't even let him move her stuff. So.
Yeah, all her books for her class she's going to take. Mm-hmm. So now Lou does get back home. It's very dark inside their home, by the way, very ominous looking. And his wife starts detecting with Lou now. Do you think, had she spoken to her father somehow? Did he stop by or does he live there? Did he call her? What happened?
He called because she asked about an accomplice. And he said, oh, so your dad called or something. And she's like, yeah, he likes to talk about things on his... before he goes to sleep, hash him out or something.
Yeah, so they think there might have been an accomplice in the getaway car that Rye jumped into with his bloody footprints. And.
But why would they drive there separately?
Right, so it's more goofiness. Like, they're getting there, but they're kind of on the wrong track a few ways.
Right.
We see that Molly has made her dad an ashtray in school, but Lou doesn't smoke.
That's funny. That's sweet. That's such a little kid thing.
And
that's
easy to make.
Yeah, that's great.
And Lou looks extremely stressed out. Explains Keith Carradine. Is it Keith Carradine? The old Lou in season one looks totally aged and worn out. And this explains, like, he's got a hard life, this guy.
Well, it is like 30 years later.
I know, but he doesn't just look 30. He doesn't look like he's 58 or 60. He looks like he's a stressed 60.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So Kirsten, Peggy, I guess. Peggy and Ed talk about her taking these new courses or this new course. And they kind of talk about their aspirations a little bit here. This is an interesting scene. This Ed and Peggy is a really interesting relationship.
Yes.
She's taking new courses. Ed might take over the butcher shop, which he thinks is totally great. But she looks really unimpressed by this, Michelle.
Yes, she does. Their whole relationship seems really almost, I don't know if I want to say one-sided, but it's certainly not an equal relationship. He wants to settle down and own the butcher shop. He wanted her to take over the salon. Evidently, she works in a salon, I think. We'll see later. And unless she has a whole bunch of kids, and of course, then he wants her at home. And did you see the look on her face? I mean, it was great. She totally played that part great with the facial expressions and stuff as he was talking.
Yeah, she looks really cherubic and Midwestern. And
yeah, but she also looks, as soon as he starts talking about kids, she gets this look on her face, and you can tell she's trying not to have kids.
Did you ever see the movie A Simple Plan with Billy Bob Thornton, where the plane crashes, they find money in it, they decide to keep the money? Billy Bob Thornton's kind of the dopey, half-witted brother. And Brigitte Fonda is the wife of the guy, and she's totally unhappy living in the town, and she wants to keep the money from the plane. And it's like kind of a drug deal.
Yeah.
You see that movie? It's called A
really
Simple Plan.
Ringing a bell.
It's
yeah.
a really good movie. And this reminded me, this Peggy reminded me of Brigitte Fonda. Like, I'm not happy at all living here. I need a ticket out of this place. Having babies and moving up into the butcher shop is not my plan in life.
Well, right, and a little bit later on, they show her flashing to looking in the mirror, and she has the Hollywood, California postcard up. She don't want to be there. I don't know if she doesn't want to be with him or if she doesn't want to be there, but
she doesn't want to have the baby either.
No,
she's really disinterested in the baby. So while this is going on, they're kind of comparing these notes about, well, I'm going to take this course. Well, I'm going to take over the butcher shop. I'm happy like you are, honey. He's kind of blind to her not being happy. And then
but he does stop and ask her, because she's talking about taking that course. She's like, everybody's taking it. I just need to work on some things. And he's like, but we're okay, right? And as soon as she goes, yeah, he digs back into his hamburger helper.
All right. Well, there's a huge number of questions we have about this couple, because this is all in the context of her having driven home with a body stuck through her windshield. She makes dinner and starts telling him about her plans to go to night school or whatever. But they do hear the sound in the garage, and it's Zombie Rye moping around. And Kirsten now tries to distract Jesse with the baby-making plan. Let's do some baby-making. I'll even wear the nightie that you like.
Yeah, if he would have fallen for that, that would have been too much. I mean, you can hear something. It sounds like somebody breaking into your garage when it wasn't just a little noise or something.
Well, he sounds like a zombie. He's not really making clear human noises. He's grunting and groaning and bumping into stuff.
Well, right. Yeah, and what was that? Was it like a head injury or what?
It was a bilateral contusion, Michelle, of the third thorax. No, I don't know. But Ed goes out to the garage.
You obviously don't know, but okay.
He sees the deer-struck Corvair. It's all bloody and messy. It looks really bad. And Rye's scuffling around. And Kristen says, don't look. Or whatever. Don't do whatever I don't want you to do. Ed has a crappy flashlight to add to the drama that won't stay on.
I know. It's like change the batteries in that flashlight.
Yeah, or the switch is dirty or something.
Yeah.
So then they see Rye, and he attacks Ed, who promptly kills him with a potting shovel. And then we hear more of those bells.
I got to watch that. But you can't blame Ed for killing him. I mean, he was attacked.
Yeah,
and I was pretty mad at Peggy.
Who's blaming Ed for anything?
Peggy did, is what I'm kind of saying. She didn't tell Ed, hey, I hit a guy. He could be over in the corner. She knew the deer that she said she hit wasn't still in the window, right? And she hears the sound over there, and she didn't tell him, and that could have gotten him killed. I mean, there's a guy in there, and she didn't even warn him.
Wait, there's a guy in there?
Yeah, a guy.
All right, these are my 10 questions about Peggy.
Oh, Lord.
Number one, why did she bring him home? Why did she just drive home? These are rhetorical. You don't have to answer them.
Yeah.
Number two, why did she lie about it? Number three.
Yeah, what did she think she was going to do? I mean, how did she think she was going to be able to lie about that? And what about the way she acted, too, when it showed the flashbacks? Her, she's telling him she panicked. She didn't panic. She comes in, she's like, you know, fixing her eyebrows and goes about making hamburger helper and tater tots.
Cleaning a drop of blood off her collar.
Yeah, like that's the annoyance.
Yeah, I only have 9 because I went for 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. I don't have a 3.
Well, that's
number 4, why did she not warn Ed, like you said? She didn't warn him. There's a murderous half. Well, she doesn't know he's murderous, probably, but there's a half-wounded guy that was in my windshield in the garage.
Right, who's probably at the least ticked off.
Why did she not call the police or the hospital? Why did she drive back that way, all the way home?
And well, then, she took the back roads, Mike.
What? Oh, you're stealing my thunder, Michelle.
Sorry.
Why did she calmly make dinner? Why did she suggest all these weird... The courses she's going to take aren't accounting. They're like self-realization courses.
Mm-hmm.
Like weird, like, I'm going to really find out about what makes myself tick. And here she is driving a corpse home in her windshield. Or about to be corpse.
Well, right. What she thinks is a corpse.
And then why did she create this need for the huge cover-up and suggest running off to California? We could just run away from this, Michelle. We'll run away and live a new life. It's just wacky. It none of these things make any sense at all.
No, I mean, she has absolutely brought upon every bit of trouble that we can only anticipate is going to ensue. It's completely her fault. And why, I've got your number 10, why would he go along with it?
Well, she's wearing the pants.
I guess, but I mean, there's only so far them pants will carry you, you
she
know?
She does say, this'll ruin everything that we dream of, our babies and our plans together. And our. She plays up on all the stuff he wants to really hear and have happen. It's exactly like a simple plan. The wife holds the puppet strings and manipulates this guy.
I guess, but that's a big evil. Manipulation. And the thing about it is, she didn't do anything wrong except drove away. She didn't. I mean, then that was obviously wrong. But she didn't mean to hit him. He ran in the road, and Ed didn't do anything wrong.
Well, unless she sees this as her ticket out of this dead end town.
You're right.
But, you know, I don't know. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, why not just leave? Why not just get divorced? She's maybe thinking up something bigger. There's something bigger going to come of this. We have, I think, a Chekhov's moment here, Michelle. Have you seen anything beyond episode 1? Any screeners or anything?
No. Only what they showed at the end, which was, you know, really vague teaser stuff. Nothing I could discern.
Yeah, I mean, there's 4 episodes out, so some people get screeners, and I haven't seen anything but episode 1.
No,
but I think there's a Chekhov's punch here. She surprises him and kind of moves up on his back. He turns around, and he clocks her. He hits her in the face. And,
yeah, that's going to come back in
some way. That's going to be used by her against him, I think. Like, he was abusing me, and...
Mm-hmm.
He was violent. Because this Jesse is a mope that's going to be used by Peggy. Or I should say Ed. But the whole Jesse Plemons, that's his role in life, is to be a mope used by other people.
I know. I want to call him Todd. So
yeah.
He's got like Jesse, Todd, Ed name. I know.
So she says, I'm sorry, honey. I thought he was dead. Like, so okay. He still didn't tell me there was a dead human stuck in our windshield of our Corvair.
Right, you ran somebody over on your way home.
And parked in the garage and made dinner and sat down and talked to me for half an hour. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention, Michelle, I murdered somebody with my car today.
Well, jeez.
Thought I'd bring it up. No, it's something, it's like maybe first thing you talk about or second, not the thing a half hour into your conversation.
You know, you might even call a spouse over something like that, you think?
Yep.
Yeah.
So we see a flashback of the accident, and we hear more Malvo bells during that. You got to listen for all these bells. They're all over the damn place.
Yeah.
And we see her during the flashback cleaning blood off her collar. And here's where she suggests this could ruin all the things we want. She says this could ruin all the things you want. We want, like, no family, no kids. This huge manipulation here by her. Huge.
Right. I'm going to go to jail if you tell anybody. You might even go to jail. Right. She scares him and scares him with the loss of what he wants in life.
So jump back to Lou and Betsy. Lou's kind of looking out the window, reflecting about life and looking at the snowfall. Betsy's in bed reading. She already looks convalescent. She already looks pretty sickly, I think.
I thought she looked great. I didn't think she looked sick at all. I thought she looked, there's obviously not a lot of sunshine, maybe a little pale up there, but at this time of year. But I thought she looked good, and I was surprised that they were showing her look that good. But
she looked emaciated. She looked thin. And
she does look thin, but she's just thin.
When they say goodnight, Mr. Salverson, goodnight, Mrs. Salverson, is that from a TV show or a movie or something?
I don't know.
Kind of eerily closing, ominously closing music. And then we see Floyd and her convalescing husband hanging out in the evening. And then we see Ed and Kirsten, Ed and Peggy, dump the body into the freezer. Guess he's a body at that point.
Yeah, not even, like, wrapped up or anything.
Michelle, in Fargo, you don't have to be dead to be dumped into something cold.
Well, that's a good point.
And we jump away totally from all this to the Kansas City gang expansion strategy. They even have PowerPoints, Michelle, back then. Pretty cool. And they're trying to accomplish the strategy of absorption of the Gerhardt Syndicate.
Okay. Had they already begun that? Is that why Floyd was talking to her husband about that they're losing money and the money's not coming in? Because they said that it wasn't all raw.
I thought they talked about the Kansas City people in the very beginning, too. But maybe I just knew that and I read that into it.
I don't remember hearing it, but they knew there was something. But is his name Otis, the guy who had the stroke? He said no one would dare. You know, he was just, like, completely indignant that someone was suggesting.
Yeah, so they were talking about that. They were talking about Kansas City.
Somebody coming in.
And that the Kansas City boys are talking about how Dodd, Bear, and Rye are, like, they're the pretenders to be kings next. They're in line to be the kings. They're not going to just go away quietly.
Right.
So they say, well, what if you can't take over? What if they resist? Well, then we liquidate, and then it approved. The man in the shadow says approved. Right. Plan's approved. PowerPoint's a good presentation. You convince me. And that's the end.
I thought that was a little... That's where it threw me, that scene. There was so much going on already that having this whole other crime company, family, group come in, it was just like, I almost had True Detective flashback for just a minute, you know, season two, because it was like, oh my gosh, how much, you know, because the story is great, and then just adding that extra in, now, a lot of people completely disagree with me, they like that part of it, but I just thought that worries me. That it's going to be too much.
Well, we talked about in our preview podcast episode, preview of the series too, that the Coen brothers always say this is based on a true event and the people are changed, but the events are true. They made a point of doing that at the beginning of this.
Yeah, they did.
So I know somewhere in life that some point in time, some Kansas City gang went up to Minneapolis or Lucerne or Sioux Falls and took over the trucking industry and invaded some other gang's territory. You know that's true. I totally believe that's true. You know, these guys are never happy with what they have. They're always... And it's interesting that a Kansas City gang or a Minnesota gang can be equally as vicious as, like, a New Jersey, you know, burying people in the Meadowlands concrete gang. I totally believe it's true.
Yeah, I'm not even talking about the truth or not factor of it, though. It's just there's so much going on already. You've got the Gerhardt family and all the dynamic that's going on in that. And then you've got the Blomquists. And then you've got the Sulversons and extended family. And Betsy being sick and raising Molly. And then you know, Peggy hitting this guy. And now he's going to die, and you got all this chaos and all this stuff going on. And then the last, like, 3 minutes, they throw in this whole, okay, this group is going to come in and, you know, wreck some havoc with what's already a chaotic situation. And I just hope it's not too much.
It's not. They did that in season one. They had the criminal stuff, and then they had the Key and Peele guys, and they had the other gang in the other building. It was all...
They did, and they worked it in beautifully. I don't know, Mike. I loved it up until then. I thought it was brilliant and really put together, but that just felt... It's probably just me, but
You're just
jaded
by True Detective.
Maybe.
They threw too many characters at you, and you're shutting your blinds.
Maybe.
All right, Michelle, that's it for Season 2, Episode 1, Waiting on Dutch, or whatever it was, Waiting for Dutch.
Yep.
So, if you want to reach me, you can reach me at Scathing Tweets. How do people find you, Michelle?
At Michelle from TN.
And I got to get out of here. The cops are after me.
Okay.
All right, Michelle, see you next time on West Coast Project for our Feed Fargo.
See you then.
On Tuesday. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Turn out the sun. All at once came a sound from inside. Then a beam made of light hit the ground. Everyone felt the sound of their heartbeat. Every man, every woman, every child. They passed the limits of imagination.